Welcome to another episode of the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Dakeel, and with me today is Duncan Smith. He's the writer and editor for 16 Wins a Ring and Piston Powered. We talk about the Boston Celtics-Cleveland Cavalier game last night. We talk about Isaiah Thomas's candidacy for MVP and a bunch of other things. Definitely enjoy the conversation. Duncan, how you doing?
I'm doing really good, actually, Mo. How about yourself?
Doing well, man. I'm doing well. Listen, I'm in LA. I got nice weather. I rarely will have complaints.
Well, I'm a little jealous. A couple days ago, it was 55 degrees up here. This morning, it snowed. So it's been quite the ride weather-wise in the in the Detroit, Windsor, Ontario area.
I don't even know what the white stuff that comes from the sky that you guys refer to as. You know, I don't even know what that really is, you know.
I can only dream. I can only dream. I'm jealous.
I always love to tease any of my guests. It's probably not a good thing to do as a host, but I always tease them about how I have nice weather.
Yeah, we don't have earthquakes, so I don't know what to tell you.
Listen, man, they're fun. Not really.
Honestly, I'm jealous. I've never been in one. I kind of want to give it a shot.
I'll be honest with you, they're not really fun. It's because there's the thing about an earthquake is you're waiting for that split second of like, is this about to get really bad?
Yeah, because we all know the one is coming. Like,
knock on wood. Hopefully,
not in our lifetimes.
Hopefully not anytime soon. I always see the predictions and I'm like, crap.
Yeah, we're overdue, aren't we? old one time. Come on.
don't tell the faults that.
Right. That's all that matters.
Yeah, as long as they don't think we're overdue, we're fine.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely not a geologist. I definitely can't really go into any further science about earthquakes, but I know basketball, and I know you know basketball, so that's why I got you on here. Let's talk about the Boston Celtics-Cleveland Cavalier game yesterday. What were some of your thoughts? Did you get a chance to watch it? What were some of your thoughts and takeaways?
I didn't actually get a chance to watch it live. I subjected myself to the misery that was that Pistons-Pelicans game last night. Oh, my God. It was bad enough that I invented a metric to express how poorly the Pistons played. It's points scored divided by field goal attempts and free throws. I decided to call it the Drummond.
I saw that on Twitter. I was like, wow, yeah. Duncan's just, this is not going to be good.
Yeah, I was in rage mode, and I feel pretty justified in that. So, no, I didn't get to watch the Cavs-Celtics game live. I got to watch snippets of it after. And then I watched the condensed game, which, I mean, basically it's a glorified highlights package, but the highlights were nice. It really looked like it was peak Kyrie and LeBron James and Isaiah Thomas just going at each other for 35 to 40 minutes combined.
And the Celtics
coming out of that with a win really impressed me, actually, I thought.
Yeah, first, I love the condensed games. If you have the league pass and don't have that set up to watch some of those condensed games, it makes my days easier, especially in the mornings when there's a ton of games and I wasn't able to catch up on everything. It lets me try to catch up on a few more games. The Celtics were very impressive last night. I thought this was one of their better games. I also think, you know, when I look at it, you know, I wonder how much does this really mean, though? It's a big win for the Celtics, but how much does it really mean in the grand scheme of things?
I think it means more for the Celtics than it does for the Cavs. If nothing else, it keeps the Celtics in stronger standing to hold that second spot. And I think if the Celtics can hold the 2 seed and maintain some distance between them and the Raptors and the Wizards, the longer you can put off having to play the Cavaliers in the playoffs, so much the better. So I think from a practical standpoint, that's the biggest thing. I'm not convinced that either team is going to really care about the feelings they have coming out of this game too much when the playoffs roll around. So, I mean, I don't think that any kind of momentum has been established one way or the other. I don't think any kind of psychological or emotional domination has been set into motion. But I do think that the more likely the Celtics are to not have to face the Cavs until the finals, like the Eastern Conference Finals, so much the better. So I think basically the only real difference is from the numbers point of view.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's one thing I would say more so for the Celtics. The Cavs don't have to worry. Like, they're fine. They didn't have J.R. Smith. They didn't have Kevin Love. They're still going to be the team to beat in the East, you know, especially when they get those guys back. For the Celtics, I think it was important, though, to get a win against a big team. You know, they lost the showdown in Washington a few weeks ago. They haven't beaten the Raptors yet. You know, I think, you know, for them, they needed to get one of those wins under their belt, you know, to kind of feel a little more confident, a little more better about themselves and kind of work their way into the season. I got to say, though, the coaching in this game was phenomenal from both teams. I call it coaches porn, and I was very excited by this game. Like, this was, you know, from Coach Luke setting up a great play for Kyle Korver for three. I thought that was awesome. I thought the little earlier, probably like somewhere in the fourth quarter, but the Celtics running the flex action to get Jaylen Brown a lob, you know, and I've been really impressed with how well he played. He had a great defensive game for them. And then I was just blown away by the defense of the Celtics. You know, Marcus Smart took a couple of charges. God, I'm so bad with names this morning. Avery Bradley was phenomenal down the stretch on Kyrie. You know, for me, that's what got that just made my night after that. And then I had to follow it up with that crappy Clippers Houston game where the Clippers just shat the bed.
That third quarter was really something.
It was a brutal game, man. Like, just it just made me go. You know, I looked at it and was just like, God, the Clippers really don't have a chance.
No.
And it sucks because you have Chris Paul and Blake Griffin. You think, like, yeah, they should be. No. They can't beat any of these teams.
Yeah, they're definitely on the outside looking in. They're sort of in that maybe third tier in the West. Because, I mean, obviously the Warriors are their own tier. And then I think the Spurs and the Rockets then are pretty much the entirety of the second tier. And then the Clippers are just, you know, one of those really good teams that is not going to make any noise in the playoffs, barring injury or unfortunate circumstance.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the situation for them. You know, I thought they were going to really benefit from the KD injury, and I was going to look at it more. I was looking at it kind of like, you know, if the Spurs could somehow get the one seed from the Warriors, which I don't think they will, but if they do, I think the Clippers match up with the Spurs better than any of those other teams. But even then, it's still really difficult for them to kind of get over the top there. And I just think, you know, that was my real pitch for the only way the Clippers can really I dropped my mic. That's really the only way the Clippers had a chance to. It's not a good mic drop. This wasn't like I made my point and I'm leaving.
Mamba out.
Yeah, and I'm out. Just you sitting on my podcast going, oh, where'd Mo go?
Where'd he go? All right, well, I guess I'm going to carry the show today.
My four or five fans would probably like that better. You know, but yeah, I think it's just one of those things. I just don't think the Clippers really got it anymore. And after watching that game, I was like, yep, nope, they don't benefit from the KD injury at all. They're just not good enough.
Yeah, I think their ceiling is pretty much realized.
Well, you know, I know we're going to talk about it later, but let's just move it up to now, because we do have a topic that will probably monopolize the rest of our conversation, which we'll get to a little later. the KD injury, who does benefit, you think, from the KD injury?
I don't think anybody is really in a position to benefit from it. I think the Warriors pretty much have that one seed locked down. The Spurs, I would say, more or less, are going to have to sweep the Warriors. They have three more matchups between the two of them. I think the Spurs are 3.5 games behind the Warriors. Yep, 3.5 back. It's going to take the Spurs sweeping the season series against the Warriors for them to really make a push. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Warriors could get at least one of those. And if any specific person or entity benefits, it's probably going to be Steph Curry, who I think is going to pretty much catch fire. I think I wrote a piece about this for 16 Wins a Ring not that long ago, in that basically letting Steph be Steph really turned things around. over that stretch where the Warriors went from having a middling to poor defense to the best defense in the NBA, and then the offense was like just shy of historic levels. That was largely due to the fact, I contend, that Steph Curry stopped worrying about getting Kevin Durant involved in the mix and just went out and let Steph be Steph. And I think that while the Warriors are obviously the worst team without Kevin Durant on the floor, I think overall Steph Curry is going to remind us why he's probably the best shooter that's ever played the game. And also, when he's unshackled and however you want to consider like the limitations that get put on him with having so many good players on the team with him, when he's kind of unshackled from that and can just go out and ball, I think he's still probably the most fun player to watch. Definitely the most enjoyable for me to watch. Yeah, I guess I just love these 40-foot jump shots with 18 seconds left on the shot clock.
There's definitely going to be a lot more opportunities for Steph Magic to start kind of taking over. I mean, he's not even a video game. You can't do this in NBA 2K. You can't do what he does on NBA 2K. It's just not possible. No. So I think we are going to get an opportunity to really see that. I'm a little worried about them on the defensive end just because KD really did play a big role in their defense. But again, I think you're right. Nobody's catching them. I also don't think the Spurs are going to go that crazy out of their way to try to get the one seed. If it's within their reach, sure, they'll make a run at it. But if they lose the first meeting against the Warriors, I won't be surprised if Pop starts resting guys as well. And as long as he feels comfortable where he's at the two seed, I think I wouldn't be surprised if the Spurs are just kind of like, we're good. We got this. We're fine. I do think it will be interesting to see, Matt Barnes is going to be a nice – was a pretty good pickup for them in that situation. They kind of saved them a little bit from Calderon. I don't know how much Calderon would have done. I know he would have been a third guard had they signed him. But, I think having another long guy who – he's definitely lost a step or two, but he's still pretty decent. Like, he can help a team.
Yeah, and I think that he's going to bring sort of a toughness. Not that the Warriors don't have toughness, but I think that he's going to add to the toughness and the grit that they have. Call it a Draymond very light or whatever. He's definitely going to benefit them a whole lot more than Jose Calderon was. I know there was some concern and confusion about the Warriors moving on from Bronte Weber so easily. Just to pick up Jose Calderon, that I didn't think that made a whole lot of sense. They could have been a continued audition for Weber. They could have had his defensive edge, and really all you're going to get out of Calderon is maybe a dozen minutes of play, and pretty much he'll just be a spot-up shooter, I think. Yeah, I'd say Matt Barnes is definitely going to bring something tangible and measurable to the team, whereas Jose Calderon is, he's probably not going to have as negative an impact as Anderson Barishev did last year, but no. let's not say that he's going to make any difference. And if you're in a position where Jose Calderon is making a difference and you're the Warriors, you've
already lost.
Screwed up somewhere along the way, and it's too late, yeah.
You've already lost the battle, if that's the case.
Yeah,
the other thing, too, with the Durant injury is how do you think – what do you think his timeline is? I know they said they're going to reevaluate in 4 weeks. Do you think he's coming back in 4 weeks? Do you think we're going to see him before the regular season? Do you think we're going to – he's going to miss part of the playoffs? What's your feel on that?
I feel like if he's not back in time for the first round of the playoffs, they're probably going to hold him out until the second round. Maybe he'll have an accelerated timeline for return and get back in time for the first round. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert with recovery timelines for injuries such as this. But
you stayed in a Holiday Inn Express last night?
I wish I even had that on my resume. I think that there's really no reason to rush him back other than to maybe like get his legs back under him and his cardio back under him before he plays meaningful playoff minutes. I think that's really the only reason to get him back before, say, the second round of the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that definitely benefits them that it happened at this point in the season and not so much later. Gives them a little bit more ramp-up time. Does hurt them in the respect, though, if they did want to start resting guys. You know, I thought, you know, when you have these four guys, you can Steph take the night off, these three guys got it, and then kind of rotate them in, you know, during March. But besides that, I think, you know, I think we're going to see him before the regular season ends, to be honest. I think that's probably the most likely thing.
Yeah.
But that's about it. I mean, in the KD stuff. Let's go into our debate. This is, if you follow us on Twitter, you and I have had this debate. I've debated with a lot of people about this. You know, it's been the elephant in the podcast room between you and I.
Yes.
I am of the faith that Isaiah Thomas should be in the top five MVP voting. And I get it. His defense is terrible. I am not trying to defend that at all. I know he is. I concede that point. I still think he should be in the top five MVP voting.
I mean, you could throw him a courtesy bone, I guess, but
it's not even a courtesy bone, dude. Like
he's definitely the best sub-6-foot player in the NBA, without a doubt, no question about it. He is, no question.
But I'm not even looking at his size. Like, I'm not going like, oh, it's cute. You know, this
we're not giving him the handicap.
You know, I'm not even looking at it. Like, it doesn't, yeah. I mean, it doesn't factor into me one way or the other of like, he should get more praise because he's, you know, smaller than these guys. I'm like, no, he shouldn't. He should get praise because he's balling out offensively. You know, he's hitting shots where I'm just like, okay. You know, yeah, I'm like, and I'm of the guy. Listen, you can go through my stuff. I've written this season, the Celtics, if they really want to contend, they're going to have to get a real closer. So I know in the playoffs, it's going to be really difficult for him. I think they're going to have a very hard time in the playoffs. But when you look at what he's done in the regular season, the fact that he's a net positive with his defense being as god-awful as it is pretty impressive.
Yeah. It does reflect really highly on the offense. It's quite impressive that he is able to be a net positive while basically being, you know, more or less, I guess a sieve is a little unkind defensively, but, you know, he's no stopper. He's certainly no stopper.
And your teams go at him. I get it, too. You know, on the defensive end, teams are trying. You know, last night when the Cavs were going down for their last possession, you know, Coach Lou didn't even call a timeout because he knew Boston would have taken Thomas out of the game to get that stop. So he didn't even bother calling a timeout. You know, they were able to keep Avery on Kyrie, so they're able to, you know, avoid that for the Celtics end. But I know teams are going at him defensively. I think he's definitely a weak point there. There are ways to hide him. I mean, they have enough good defensive players and guards to try to hide him. He doesn't have to guard the best player. And you're not wrong when you call him a defensive sieve. Like, you were trying to be nice. I'll be brutally honest. You know, he'll give up points. But he'll give up a two and get you a three on the other end.
Yeah, he does have that quality to him. The thing is, he has been so good that we were talking about who benefits from KD's injury. When it comes to, like, a top five ranking for MVP, Isaiah Thomas might be the guy that benefits from it. So I'm just kind of like running through my own computations as to who my top five is. I haven't really expanded past like the top three with basically I'd say it's right now my top three would be James Harden, Russ, and then Kawhi. I haven't really expanded beyond that because I don't think anybody else has a legitimate case for it. But if we were to go beyond those three, then I think we're looking at LeBron and then KD. Probably in that order, I guess, because Durant has been spectacular. He's shown a defensive side that I don't think that we knew he had. And, you know, offensively, he might be the most dangerous scorer in the NBA. So, you know, you combine those things and throw him on one of the best teams in NBA history, you know, whatever, give him some votes for MVP. But he's going to miss a month and a half, potentially. And so, you know, there goes his outside shot at MVP. And I might have Isaiah Thomas at number six.
So now he might back his way into it.
He might back his way into it. You know, if we had this discussion a week ago, I could probably ride that top five till I die kind of thing. But now Kevin Durant's injury is softening my stance slightly. Although, you know, beyond just saying that, like, he's a for sure top six, maybe now top five candidate. You know, that's his ceiling.
Yeah, and he shouldn't be higher than five. I agree with you on that. You know, I think, but here's my argument with against KD's MVP thing, and this is before he got injured. Let's assume he even plays this year. Mm-hmm. He's been phenomenal on the defensive end, no question about it. He is gifted on the offensive end to the degree that defenses have to worry about him, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry. You know, when you have that kind of shooters out there, like, it is easier for you. I mean, that was Golden State's pitch to him. Like, it'll be easier for you. So, you know, I feel like I when Isaiah Thomas is on the court, I would just commit two guys to him, you know, and just be like, that's it. We're doubling. We're trapping the crap out of him, and we're going to have the other Celtics beat us, you know. And I think that's kind of the thing. And I'm not a huge analytics guy. I believe the importance in analytics, but I also, you know, I'm not as versed with the numbers as everybody else was. But in preparing for our discussion, I looked up the clutch numbers, net rating for these guys in MVP, the guys we've kind of just talked about in the MVP race. Mm-hmm. Do you want to venture a guess where IT ranks?
I'm going to guess probably number two behind Russ.
Actually, he's number three behind Kawhi. It's Russ is ahead of everybody by leaps and bounds. He's at his net rating's at 28.4, assuming I didn't write that wrong. Sometimes I can't read my own handwriting, so it could be an eight or a five. But either way, he's way ahead of everybody.
Yeah, I think his usage is something like 70% or something. Just
I'm shocked.
Ridiculous.
100.
Sometimes, you know, Kyle Singler gets the ball by accident and he has to shoot it.
Yeah, right. It's like, oh, crap. You know, you know who Kyle Singler is in that situation? He's the guy when you play pickup with who you don't pass the ball to all game. And the one time he gets it, it's right around game point. And he's like, fuck you guys, I'm shooting.
Yep, I've got strong feelings about Kyle Singler. He was a Piston for a couple years, so we're acquainted. We're acquainted.
You know him very well.
Uh-huh.
Kawhi's second at 18.4. And then Isaiah Thomas at 14.4. LeBron James at 12.6. KD at 6.6. And then you have Harden at 2.7. I get everybody wants to kill him. But, like, when I just look at Isaiah Thomas and the Celtics being at the two seed, I'm like, there's no way they win the games they're winning without this guy. And he hurts them defensively, but he fucking saves them offensively.
Yeah, there's no question about that. The downside of like clutch performance or whatever, however you want to term it, this is a conversation actually I think that put us both on each other's radars a week or so ago.
Right.
Is that I kind of have the assertion that games where you get into the clutch essentially turn into coin flips. You know, it comes back to, like, say there's a general understanding that, like, your net rating is more indicative of your overall team's value, quality, ability than record is. And, you know, if you take that to the next logical step, if you haven't created enough of a separation between yourself and your opponent, once you get down to the last 5 minutes, becomes a chance plays a much greater role in, like, who actually gets the win and the loss. You know, like say we're down to 2 minutes, it's tied, both teams probably get the ball four times. And, you know, it doesn't matter necessarily unless there's like a gigantic skill edge between the two teams. It's really hard for skill edges to be realized over four possessions. You know, you've got situations like I think the Sixers and the Warriors had a situation like this last year. The Sixers were historically bad in the clutch. I think they were something like minus 50 net rating in like last 5 minute plus minus 5 point situations. And then the Warriors with their death lineup were, you know, they were on the flip side of the coin historic. So that's a situation where even though it's only four or five possessions that you've got left, like you expect that edge to be realized. But, you know, there's very little difference between the middle 20 teams as far as expectation on each possession. So while it's really great to have a player who can execute in the clutch and have guys that function well in the clutch around him, it still comes down to like razor thin edges. And, you know, sometimes even when you're putting up like 60% shots, like shots that have that kind of expectation of going in, you know, that's very often going to find you on the wrong side of variance. I think I was looking at the Basketball Reference expected win totals for the Celtics. As of yesterday, I believe they were, I think, four games ahead of their expected value or their expected record based on like net rating, you know, the different variables that go into that. So like it's just as easy for a team to be four games above as it is for them to be four games, five games, six games below. I think when we get down to like the last 2 minutes, I don't have this stat right in front of me right now, but when we were looking at this last week, there I think were three or four teams that had losing records in the clutch that had net ratings that were within like a point of the Celtics clutch net ratings. And like I think one of them was like the Phoenix Suns. So, you know, if the Suns can be like four games below their expected record, then it's just as easy for the Celtics to be like several games ahead of theirs. So, you know, that's not to discredit what Thomas is doing, but it's also, you know, when regression to the mean kicks in, it's a bitch when you get into such a high variance situation as relying upon clutch play.
Yeah, I mean, first off, you said a lot of words there that were phenomenal.
Sorry, I just kind of ran away with it here.
It was awesome. Yeah. It was awesome because I can't do that. and
I just know a few interesting stats and know how to spin it in an interesting way that, you know, just use a couple big words and everybody's like, okay, sure, go ahead.
All right, whatever, you win, right?
Yeah. Well, all right, fine, shut up, you win, get it.
I'm waiting for Mara, who jumped into our conversation on Twitter last week, to come in and start pulling out stats out of her bag.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Usually when I throw a couple stats out there, it has the effect that I just referred to, but then, you know, I like stats, but, like, Mara is a whole different story. I was like, all right, I'm about to get trounced, but this is going to be fun.
It was amazing. I was watching this whole thing going like, oh, wow.
Yeah, it was the clash of a Titan and a paper tiger in my case.
Yeah, but it was awesome. And I get what you're saying in the sense of like, look, clutch games, it's a coin flip, it's a toss-up. But there's also sort of a thing where I kind of feel that it's like, who do you want on your side at that point? And it's different, right? Listen, I would always want LeBron on my side in that situation, or a Curry or things like that. When you see what he's doing in these clutch games, and Isaiah Thomas has failed in clutch situations, absolutely, everybody has, I still kind of think it's hard because I don't feel stats really kind of ultimately help us with clutch situations, because I know there's always a debate of what is clutch, is there even a thing called clutch, the whole situation. That's a debate for another time, and you can own me on that one when you kick out the statistics there. But, you know, I believe there is a thing of clutch, and I just don't think analytics can really kind of pinpoint it, even though I did use a clutch stat. So it's kind of, I guess, counterintuitive or I'm going against my own self here on this one. But I just look at him and I just think for what he's doing, he's in my top five MVP, even if KD didn't get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, and KD's six. Like, it's not, I mean, for me, and it's, and it's not really, really close. I obviously knew we weren't going to change each other's mind in this debate. But I thought it was an important one for us to at least get out there.
Yeah, I think so. And I think this is also not necessarily a situation where we're trying to change each other's mind, change each other's minds. I get into plenty of debates where nobody's mind changes, but, you know, different aspects. I'm gesturing with my hands here.
My favorite. I do it all the time.
Are, yeah. Different aspects of a situation are explored, you know. It's not so much like a situation where I'm right and here's where you're wrong. It's more a matter of there are different ways to look at it, and this topic becomes more interesting if we look at it from different perspectives. There's really no right or wrong because, you know, there's no fifth MVP award anyway. Like, there's no way to be right or wrong about this. It's just a really interesting topic that the more different angles you can find to look at it, the more interesting it becomes. And if I can throw one more thing in about the whole clutch, whether it does or does not exist, I think the main studies that have been done on clutch show that it's not so much that clutch exists, it's that unclutch exists. So it's not so much that players like raise their game, other than, like, of course, Russell Westbrook might be putting a lie to this. maybe he's, you know, it's like he's saving energy for the fourth quarter or anything either. He's
in
all the
shape,
rules
man.
Go out the window. Yeah, that guy just doesn't stop.
Right.
In most cases, it's not that, like, great players play even better in the clutch. It's just that non-great players play worse. So when you've got a team like the Sixers, for example, that are, you know, especially last year, and this current squad right now, minus Embiid and so forth, they more or less will wilt in the spotlight, whereas LeBron James will more or less play the game kind of like it's, you know, it's the 47th minute, but it might as well be the 12th minute because he's going to do what he's going to do because he's the best player in the world. An opposition full of players who are wilting from the spotlight in front of one of the best players in the NBA, perhaps one of the best players ever, that's going to reflect very strongly on LeBron's clutch performance. So it's not exactly that he's got a Superman gear, although, again, LeBron has a Superman gear. But it's more like he's up against an average or below average team that then becomes worse because they aren't prepared to deal with the kind of heat that a guy like LeBron or Steph or Russell Westbrook or Isaiah Thomas can bring. So, a lot of words, but that's really all I have to say about that is that clutchness doesn't exist, but unclutchness does exist. And I think it's pretty prevalent against like the non-great players. So that's where I'd say that's where Isaiah Thomas has a big edge as far as the existence of clutchness. Effectively.
Definitely a good point. There are definitely players that shit the bed when the game's on the line. We can go on about this for hours easily. But I don't think anybody would listen past that point. I'm not sure how many people are listening now.
They've all turned it off by now.
Yeah, you know, but besides that, you know, before we get into anything else, I do got to ask you a random question. What's your take on gelato?
It's not my favorite, but I'm typically not like a dessert kind of guy myself. I like meat. If I'm gonna eat, I'd like to eat some meat.
We'll challenge my friends at Uli's Gelateria to make a meat gelato that we will serve to the great Duncan Smith one day. But just down here in downtown LA, in the Spring Arcade, is my favorite gelato shop, Uli's Gelateria. They are phenomenal. I am gaining weight by the day with the amount of gelato that I eat from them. You know, and I'm not a great spokesman in the sense of, like, I don't change. I'm a creature of habit. It's sea salt caramel and speculoos cookies every time. And it's like I walk in, they know that's what I want. But they got several flavors, pistachio, anything you want besides meat. We'll get them to work on that, Duncan, I promise.
I'll make the trip out west. I'll brave the earthquakes if they can make that.
There we go. I'm gonna let them know. Like, we can get Duncan here if you guys can come up with a meat gelato. Doesn't even, you know, they'll make it good. I'll be shocked if it's good, but they'll do their best. But if they can make the meat gelato, we're gonna get the great Duncan Smith here in LA. And I'll
doesn't have. Doesn't have to be good, just has to exist.
Okay. Is there a particular meat you want? Is there a...
I like a good steak.
Okay,
if so they can figure out some way to do that.
Here we go. One day coming from Uli's Gelateria is the T-bone gelato.
Beautiful.
And,
I'm in.
And we'll get you the first taste. But if anybody's in LA, in downtown LA, again, it's on Spring Street, in between 5th and 6th in the Spring Arcade. You can't go wrong. It's a great, great treat, pretty light, phenomenal. I highly recommend it. And now back to basketball. We touched a little bit on the Pistons, and it would actually kind of be stupid for me not to talk a little Pistons with you while I have you on here. I love KCP.
Yeah.
What's the story there? He's the restricted free agent this year. You know, I'm guessing they're going to match anything, right?
Yeah, they're definitely going to match anything. If you don't, then he walks and the Pistons don't have any cap space to replace him in the free agent market with anyway. So if he walks, then the Pistons get to throw Darren Hilliard or an out of position Stanley Johnson into the starting shooting guard position. And Johnson's really coming along lately, but you know he's not a a starter by any means. He's certainly not a starting shooting guard. And Darren Hilliard, I think he's probably going to play pretty well for the Grand Rapids Drive next season. And I really wanted things to go well for Hilliard, but I don't think they're gonna. I think that we've seen what we're going to get out of him, and you know, took a shot, and that's going to be that. My guess is that the Pistons aren't going to open themselves up to getting to other teams presenting him with an offer sheet to match. I kind of think that the Pistons are going to offer him more years for a little bit more money and get a per year discount. So I think from what Keith Smith from 16 Wins a Ring and Real GM told me when we were talking about this, the most a team can offer him is 4 years, $103 million. And the Pistons can go 5 years, $130 million, I believe. But I think that what we might see is the Pistons go 5 years, $110 million. So they get an extra year. And instead of paying him $25 million per, they pay him $22 million. Get a little bit of a discount, get an extended... maybe even a player option in the fifth year or whatever, but just get that extra year in there and save a little money.
Fair enough. And quick question, Keith Smith, relation?
No relation. There just happened to be a lot of us.
I mean, obviously Smith is a popular last name, but I put two and two together seeing that you're both at 16 Wins a Ring. I was like, oh, this could be a brother or cousin connection.
No, we didn't have any kind of connection until stumbling across each other in the NBA Twitter universe, and through a thorough investigation. Actually, we've done no investigation whatsoever, but there's really no chance that we're related in any way.
Okay.
other than you know, maybe like hundreds of years back in like the origination of the Smith name, but I think that there might be multiple multiple trees of Smiths, not so much branches from the same tree.
If we go really, really way back, we're all kind of related. So
yeah, we're all from the Fertile Crescent ultimately, and I think that's pretty much where our genetic match begins and ends.
Great. What's another one of your favorite NBA storylines right now, or something that's kind of keeping your interest right now?
The Rockets are fascinating. I think I had them with, I think I predicted them coming in with 42 wins this season, and I forget if they've got 41 wins or 42 wins right now. 43 wins. They've already surpassed my win total for them this season. Yeah, man, there are some teams I nailed, and there are some teams I really dropped the ball on.
Right, well, it's the same way. Everybody has that, right?
Yeah, if it wasn't for the fact that the Lakers got off to that really hot, that hot start, I would have been really close to my prediction on them too. They were 10-10 after 20 games. I think I had them with 16 wins. They're pretty much on 16 win pace
now. Right.
Since then, yeah. So, oh well, I missed that one, but I got a couple others right.
But I got you. I got you off topic there. You were talking about the Rockets. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the Rockets have been one of my favorite storylines. James Harden, I consider his season to be somewhat of a redemption. Actually, my debut post for 16 Wins a Ring was on this redemptive season that Harden's had. There was kind of a dark cloud over Harden and the Rockets after the fairly disastrous season they had last year. Then they brought D'Antoni in and more or less allowed Harden to do what he does best, and that's just basically create offense, and he's done an excellent job of being one of the best facilitators in the NBA. He's really let his playmaking creativity flourish this season, I think, in ways that most people didn't really realize he had. And of course, there are not many better scorers and finishers in the NBA than Harden, and it's made me very happy to see him have, you know, not many guys can go out and score 29 points and then need redemption the next season, but Harden did, I think. And he's done that, I think, with pretty much with flying colors, I'd say. He's had a great season, and it makes me very happy to see that.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, the redemption he needed, a lot of it was just because he was so apathetic on the defensive end. And it was just kind of, it was bad, man. You would watch games and, you know, at least once a game, he would just not bother to defend his guy. I mean, he would look like, I don't know if you saw the clip last night of Jahlil Okafor in Miami, basically just standing. That was it.
Yep.
He didn't do anything. And you would see that with Harden last year, and he would get back cut like at least once a game. And I was always like, oh, this is killing me. So I'm happy to see his redemption. I'm happy to see Mike D'Antoni's redemption as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, after he had left Phoenix, it was really a struggle for him, you know, trying to find a team that would let him kind of go in. And the Morey, D'Antoni, Harden relationship just feels like a match made in heaven.
It really does. The way that this team has really come together, like this triumvirate, at least, between Morey and Harden and D'Antoni, has been maybe the best union in the NBA as far as what Harden brings to the table and Morey and D'Antoni's philosophies. I say every so often on Twitter that, like, I look at the Rockets shot chart to detox after Piston games, because the Pistons love mid-range jumpers and they're bad at them. And, you know, you look at a Rockets game, a shot chart for an entire game, and there'll be like three shots that aren't in the paint or three-pointers in the course of the entire game, and they're all James Harden jumpers, which are just fine. And it's really impressive to see a vision come together as fully realized as Daryl Morey's has with the personalities put on that team.
Yeah, I mean, he's done a good job. They found guys, Montrezl Harrell, Nene and Capella as their bigs have been really great for them. You know, they didn't miss a beat when Capella went out. I do want to I stepped into it a little bit last night on Twitter. Twitter's a fascinating place if you haven't really gone on there. And NBA Twitter is really interesting. I know you have, but talking to the fans now, all four.
The fans, the people, yeah.
The people, and, you know, whatever dog happens to be forced to listen to this.
Sorry, dog.
Yeah. I'm saddened by the fact that we're eventually just going to have an NBA where it's you're either shooting a three or a layup. Like, I'm not that enthused about that. You know, I think eventually we're going to have every team jump on it. You know, it's great to see Houston doing it, and they're having a lot of success. You know, I know the analytics make sense. The numbers behind it make sense. Every team should be doing it. I like the mid-range game. I like watching coaches make diagram plays and set up stuff that gets you shots all over the courts. You know, Do you think this is going to be something that's going to be a regular occurrence? Like, at some point, we're just going to have it where the NBA game is, like, you either get a layup or a three, and every now and then somebody like DeMar DeRozan shoots mid-ranges very well.
I think we're getting closer to that point. I think that with the NBA being a copycat league, the main reason that more teams aren't going that way is that while it's a copycat league, I think coaches are creatures of habit and in some cases dinosaurs. You know, they will probably not adapt fast enough to survive in some cases. I think Randy Whitman is one example. He did try last season to sort of catch up, but the execution was flawed. Whether it be, you know, his fault or the fault of the personnel that he had on the court, you know, it doesn't necessarily really matter, because I think that that kind of philosophy is more of an organizational thing, because you can't just be a coach that says,
right,
I'm going to do all layups and three-pointers and that's it. You know, I think that, you know, a very intelligent, modern-looking coach like Stan Van Gundy would love to have a team that shoots all three-pointers and layups. But they also, the team that he has leads the NBA most nights in mid-range jump shots. I don't think that that's schematically something that he is looking to create. And, you know, you're going to find that with some coaches around the NBA. They just don't have the people. And, you know, what you want to do might be less important than what you can do based on the team that you have. And so because of that, it's going to take some time. And I think some players and some play styles will get phased out over the years. Like, you know, a guy like Jahlil Okafor, for example.
Yeah, the post is gone.
Andre Drummond, they're just going to be less valuable as the NBA evolves. Yeah, like, you know, the post-up is, it's something that's great if you want to get, like, 0.8 points per possession, dependably. You know, why do you want to do that when you can get, like, a touch over 1 point per 1 point per possession on average with an average three-point shooter? Like, you know, it's going to become just simply logical to give up those low expectation post shots for higher value layups, drives to the basket, three-pointers, and other offense like that. But the nice thing about offense like that is that very often, like, it does require you know, at least a two-man game. It's not iso ball per se.
Right.
You know, iso ball I think leads to a lot of drive past your guy and then pull up for a jump shot. You know, so there's your mid-ranger that you're looking at. But at the same time, like, look at a team like the Warriors. They don't shoot many mid-range jump shots, but they do run a lot of intricate, interesting motion and plays. And, you know, if that's where the NBA is going, I think that's interesting. I think that's an exciting direction for the NBA to go to.
I hope you're right. I hope I'm wrong in this one, because I think it's just going to make me really sad. I think I'm going to get really bored with the game pretty quick. I think,
yeah.
And I think the game is going to get a little boring and watered down in that sense. I think it's fun now when teams are doing something like this where it's interesting and exciting, and you're seeing all of it, you know, and we saw it 10 years ago, maybe even before that, when he was doing it in Phoenix with the team. And I think it'll be interesting to see what's going to happen, but it's going to be rough for me. I'm not going to lie to you, Duncan. It's going to hurt me a bit.
The nice thing is that I don't think there's going to be just a straight line from coaches loving the mid-range jump shot and saying things like, well, he's open, why wouldn't you just take it? You know, he's open for a reason, that whole retorted cliche. I don't think there's necessarily going to be a straight line from that to, like, ruthless efficiency, as some people have called what Daryl Morey does. I think there's going to be some bumps along the way for a lot of teams, and I think that you might find some interest in that as they kind of find their way along and decide if they want to go with where the NBA is going, or if they maybe can innovate something else. You know, not every team wants to just shoot layups and threes. The teams that aren't equipped to do that, you know, they may very well find a different way. Like, the Spurs are not a Morey ball type offense, for example. They've got a lot of guys who can shoot mid-range jumpers, and they make it work. You know, not every team is Pop. Most teams don't have Kawhi Leonard. or LaMarcus Aldridge, et cetera, et cetera. You know, guys who are like mid-range specialists. But there's always going to be more than one thing that works. So I don't think that it's quite the doom and gloom that you're afraid of.
Well, again, I hope you're right. I hope I'm wrong. We'll see what happens. You know, if you see me disappear 5-10 years from now, that's why. I'm like, I'm out. I quit. I'm going to go watch badminton.
Time for a new hobby.
Yeah, that's it. I'm going to start writing about badminton. Anyways, Duncan, I really appreciate you jumping on. Where can my fans and the dog find you?
Well, my writing is on Piston Power pretty much on a daily basis. 16 Wins a Ring, a little bit less frequent, but I write and edit over there. They can follow me on Twitter at DuncanSmithNBA. And those are really the main things that I do stuff on at the moment.
Perfect. Well, if people aren't following you now, everybody should jump on it. I mean, just for the pure fact that you make up metrics when you're bored. I think that's well, that's really enjoyable.
Yeah. I mean, I like really basic math that can sound complicated. So I more or less, I'm a know-it-all. And it's kind of a character flaw on my part. So
That's the entire NBA Twitter. You just described all of us on NBA Twitter. None of us have ever been wrong.
It really is. Yeah. And when I discover something I've been wrong about, I like to double it down and swing it around in such a way that while I'm wrong now, I'm going to now explain why what you thought is now wrong. I'm you know, you've got to one up. You can't let anybody win an argument. You've got to always evolve the conversation, at least.
You heard it here first. Never concede that you're wrong.
No, just double keep down. Spinning it. Just keep spinning it.
Double down and you know, beat your opponent even just to the point of submission. They'll quit at some point.
At some point.
Well, Duncan, hey, it was great having you on, man. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And that's it for us on the Jump Ball Podcast for the day. Thank you again to Duncan Smith for joining us. Make sure to like us, rate us, and leave reviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Have yourselves a great weekend.